So I would like to ask you to be upfront with the American people. Why did you lie to get us into a war that was not necessary and that has caused these kinds of casualties? Yeah. Why?
Well, first of all, I haven't lied. I did not lie then. Colin Powell didn't lie. He spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence Agency people and prepared a presentation that I know he believed was accurate. And he presented that to the United Nations. The president spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence people. And he went to the American people and made a presentation. I'm not in the intelligence business. They gave the world their honest opinion. It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and
you
we were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
And my words were that... No. Wait a minute. Let them stay 1 second. Just a second.
This is America, huh?
Yeah. You're getting plenty of play, sir.
I just like an honest answer.
I'm giving it to you.
We're talking about lies, and your allegation that there was bulletproof evidence of ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Was that a lie, or were you misled?
Zarqawi was in Baghdad during the pre-war period. That is a fact.
Zarqawi? He was in the north of Iraq in a place where Saddam Hussein had no rule. That's where he was.
He was also in Baghdad.
Yeah, when he needed to go to the hospital. Come on, these people aren't idiots. They know the story.
You are... Let me give you an example. It's easy for you to make a charge, but why do you think that the men and women in uniform, every day when they came out of Kuwait and went into Iraq, put on chemical weapon protective suits? Because they liked the style? They honestly believed that there were chemical weapons. Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons on his own people previously. He'd used them on his neighbor, the Iranians, and they believed he had those weapons. We believed he had those weapons.
That's what we call a non sequitur. It doesn't matter what the troops believe. It matters what you believe.
I think, Mr. Secretary, the debate is over. We have other questions, courtesy to the audience.
I guess over here.
Good grief.
That's a hard act to follow.
You've forgotten your question.
Hello, and welcome to the Lies.com podcast for May 5th, 2006. If all has gone according to plan, I began this podcast by playing the audio of a really remarkable bit of CNN footage I saw on the thinkprogress.org website. It showed an appearance by Donald Rumsfeld at some sort of conference in the southeast. I apologize for not remembering the details. And in the question and answer session that followed, Ray McGovern, former CIA official, used to give the daily security briefings to President George H.W. Bush, the current Bush's father, and someone who's been an outspoken critic of the current Bush and his dishonest case for war in Iraq in particular for some time now. Anyway, he went after Rumsfeld in the Q&A and asked him some very pointed questions about why he lied about weapons of mass destruction, saying that we knew where they were. You know, he went out on TV, and Rumsfeld did in the run-up to war, and said, oh, we know where the weapons of mass destruction are. They're in the area around Tikrit. Ray McGovern really gave it to Rumsfeld, and he trotted out his talking points in response, Rumsfeld did, and was sounding relatively good. I mean, he certainly had enough practice at this. But McGovern didn't go for it, and as he was able to hit him with follow-up questions and point out the obvious lies, and as they moved on to talking about Zarqawi, it was even more obvious, as Rumsfeld talked about, you know, him being in Baghdad and this showing Saddam's ties with Al-Qaeda. McGovern pointed out, well, no, of course not. Zarqawi was operating in the northern part of Iraq, the northeastern part, in the no-fly zone. an area where Saddam did not have control, specifically because of U.S. actions. And it's come out recently, I mean, it came out a long time ago, but additional evidence has come out recently, essentially confirming the story that came out some years ago, that Bush knew where Zarqawi was, where those bases were in northern Iraq. This is after 9/11, and he was being pressured by the CIA to go after him, to go bomb those bases and take him out. But he didn't, specifically because he wanted the excuse, well, it's an assumption, but I think at this point it's pretty close to ironclad, because Bush didn't want to lose the presence of Zarqawi in Iraq, technically speaking, as part of the excuse for going to war, that it would jeopardize the case for war. And in, you know, 2003, in 2002, this was a, you know, key concern of the Bush administration, was the fact that the case for war against Iraq seemed to be eroding. As UN weapons inspectors were allowed into Iraq and were going around, they were basically finding no weapons. And public sentiment, at least world sentiment, was turning against the notion of invading Iraq. So they were desperate to do whatever they could to keep that case for war as strong as possible. And as part of that, they were willing to let a top Al-Qaeda official running a terrorist training camp in the Kurdish autonomy zone in northern Iraq, they were willing to let him stay there when they knew he was there, when they had the bombs and missiles to go after him. Good job, Bush. Anyway, McGovern didn't get into all those specifics in his debate with Rumsfeld, but as I listened to it, and granted, I'm not the most objective listener, but as someone who knows the underlying facts, when I listen to that debate, McGovern nails Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld loses the debate, and there are moments in it when you can see that in Rumsfeld's eyes. You know, if you can see the video, watch the video, just in his manner, his sort of stammering, and you can probably hear it in the audio too. Rumsfeld knew he was losing that debate. And that, coming on top of the Moussaoui verdict, tells a consistent story to me. I mean, the thing about that event that Rumsfeld spoke at that differentiated it from the normal venues where Bush administration members speak about Bush's policies is that the audience was not screened for ideological purity. They weren't screened to be, you know, universally favorable to the Bush position. And when you actually have a dialogue like that, when you actually have a debate like that, or as happened in the Moussaoui penalty phase trial, when you actually have a jury and a judge and rules of law, and both sides get to make their best case, the Bush team loses. Because on the merits, they lose the argument. Because they're wrong, because they're lying, because it's transparently obvious when you actually make a good faith effort to assemble all the relevant evidence and analyze it, they lose. It's just obvious. And it was obvious in that exchange between McGovern and Rumsfeld, and apparently it was obvious enough for the Moussaoui trial jury to reject the government's case that this person who was, you know, a bad guy, I'm not defending Moussaoui, but this was a guy who was, other than his own highly suspect confession, there was no evidence linking him with the 9/11 attacks. Our top Al-Qaeda operatives, the people we're not actually bringing to trial because we've decided it's better to keep them locked away without charges and torture them to try and extract information from them. These folks have told us that Moussaoui, you know, was a loose cannon, that in the organization he was not someone they were going to give a high-profile mission to because he wasn't reliable. And this guy who was locked up on 9/11, he was in, you know, U.S. custody when the attacks happened, this is the person we were going to put on trial and sought the death penalty for as an accomplice to these acts. And to me, that just, I mean, I posted about this in one of the very first items after I started making, after Lies.com became a real weblog, which would have been back in 2002 sometime. It was when it was first announced by the government. Within a few days of when I started doing that regular weblogging on the site, there was an item I posted about the Moussaoui charges, and I basically described it as, you know, U.S. government seeks death penalty for thought crime, because that's what it is. You know, if you lock someone up in jail, and then this bad thing happens, and then you seek the death penalty against him because he really, really wanted to be part of that, because he really, really wanted to participate in that event, but didn't, the government has no business executing someone for that. It's a thought crime. This country is founded on the principle that you can think whatever you want. That in a fundamental contest between the state and the individual, the state's interests, barring some compelling reason that puts the state's interest first, the individual's rights have to dominate. I mean, that's just the base, that's the kind of country we are. You know, we didn't want a king. And if the government is going to be given the power to regulate and punish thoughts that it does not like, you have guaranteed that what you will have will be indistinguishable from a monarchy. You will have a dictatorship. Because it's just a matter of time before you get a government leader who is willing to use the power of the state in his own political interests. And clearly we've arrived at that point now. If there's anything that's been consistent about the Bush administration, is that they are willing to use any strategy they can come up with, any power that they can find or steal or get away with exercising, as long as nobody knows about it, in their own interests, in terms of their own narrow political agenda. And they don't care what principles they sacrifice. They don't care what long-term damage they do, as long as they're serving that absolutely central goal of keeping George Bush in power. They don't care if they destroy the U.S.'s leading position in the world as an opponent of torture. They will basically use state-sanctioned torture as an instrument of policy. And yeah, they'll tap dance around it and say, we do not torture. But the evidence is clear. And the evidence clearly shows that you cannot trust anything that the Bush administration says. Anyway, that was a pretty exciting video to watch. I've really been enjoying the spring bird migration coming through where I do my local bird watching. Really want to see a black-throated gray warbler. I saw a posting to the Santa Barbara County birding list a day or two ago where someone was talking about birding at Carpinteria Creek and seeing lots of spring migrants coming through. And among them, they talked about seeing black-throated gray warblers. It's a bird I've never seen. I really should have seen it. I can only offer my defense that I haven't been birding that aggressively in the area since moving here, but they definitely come through here in the spring migration. And this would be the time to see them. Almost as just a silly little thing that you do. When the company I'm working for moved to its new offices, which they did, I think, back in January, or maybe February, they moved to this big office park. And the place consists of there's like four big buildings around the perimeter. And then in the center, there's a big open plaza area with tables, and you know, you can eat. They have some places you can buy lunch and people eat out there. And they've got some ponds, these little 6-inch deep ponds with fountains. And I started making a list in the wiki that we run for internal documentation purposes and the engineering team I work on. I created a page for, you know, bird species I'd seen or bird species seen on the building premises, and started listing the birds because, you know, something I could do on the way to and from getting my lunch. I'd walk through there and notice what was there. And this week was a great week. I sort of poo-pooed the bird life at this complex early on. It's a pretty sterile. I mean, it's landscaped to look pretty and look like it's got lush vegetation, and there's trees and some shrubbery and lots of grass, but it's pretty antiseptic. You know, I think they've got to be using a fair amount of insecticide out there to keep everything all pretty looking, with the result that it doesn't have the bird population that, as a birder, I feel like it really should have. I think the main thing is just it's too tidy. You know, if they let that place get messier, there'd be a lot more wildlife out there. But that's not what it is. You know, I understand that. So anyway, I've been keeping track of the birds I see there. And this week was a really amazing week. Monday, I was at my desk, And my desk is about 20 or 30 feet from these windows, and we're up on the fourth floor. The windows are all sealed. You know, you're not out in nature when you're working in this place. It's a great workplace. As a programmer, I really like it. It's the development team has this thing about turning the lights out, and people are very quiet, you know, to reduce glare on your monitor, and people are very quiet. I try to curb my desire to go pester people around me every few seconds with questions, because it is such a great, they're so good about just focusing on their work. I was telling someone who works in another part of the building yesterday, I was chatting with her and said that, you know, it's so quiet. Sometimes I'll be sitting there and I'm in this row of cubicles. They're not cubicles, they're like updated versions of cubicles that aren't actually cubicle. And it's got a fair amount of space, and it's a nice little workspace. But there's about, let's see, like eight of us in this aisle. And I can be sitting there working on some problem and really focusing on it and find myself wondering, gee, is everybody left? Are they all in meetings? Are they all gone home or whatever? And I'll look up and look around and no, every desk is occupied. People are just, you know, focused on their own inner world, just like I am. Anyway, so I was sitting there working on something, and I realized at a certain point that I'd been hearing for a couple of minutes a bird song, you know, high-pitched, almost subliminal, low-level sound of a song. It sounded like a warbler. I was like, wow, you know, that sounds like the bird that I was hearing singing in my street the previous weekend, last weekend, that I hunted down with binoculars, because it was a song I wasn't that familiar with. I mean, I had an idea. I wasn't sure if it was a Wilson's warbler or a yellow warbler, because I really don't know their songs too well, but I hunted him down and it was a yellow warbler. And so at the office, I'm hearing this, and I get up and I stroll over to the windows, and there's some tree, you know, there's a tree right below that side of the building, and in the treetops right below the window, there was a yellow warbler hopping around singing. And I've been making a point of bringing my binoculars into work for just such an occasion. So I pulled the binoculars up and I was checking him out. And as I'm standing there looking at him, I see this brightly colored bird flitting from one treetop to another across the aisle next to the building next door. And I get my binoculars on that, and lo and behold, it's a male western tanager, which was also a new bird for the building complex for me. So that was pretty cool. So Monday I had those two new birds to add to the list, which I think brought it up to bird number 20, species 20. Not that I'm a big lister or anything. If you listen to me rant about Sibley and my objections to twitcher culture, you know that I'm not necessarily the biggest champion of just listing for its own sake, but it's something to do at work. Then Tuesday, I had another new bird. I'm trying to remember what one that was. Oh, right. I was sitting at my desk, and I saw a bird go by the window really fast, and it looked sort of like the swallows. There's rough-winged swallows and the occasional barn swallow that I've seen in the complex for about a month now. A month ago they arrived, and I see them all the time. But this thing went by, and I thought, you know, that has sort of that tapered body and that illusion of the alternating wing beats that says to me, swift. So I went over to the window and watched, and sure enough, it was definitely a swift. I saw him swooping around at sort of the height of the building tops inside the complex, and wasn't able to see him close. I didn't have my binoculars at that point, and I don't know, I'm a little self-conscious about, you know, stopping my work in the middle of the day and pulling out my binoculars to go stand by the window, although I probably shouldn't have been, but in this case I was. So I was checking him out, and didn't come close enough for me to really identify it. It seemed fairly large, and I didn't see any white on it, so I'm thinking, huh, well, it could be a white-throated swift, but, you know, it could also be another species, probably a white-throated around here, but couldn't tell. So I was going to put it down in the wiki page is just, you know, swift species, and just count it as a species without knowing specifically which one it was. But then after I'd returned to my desk and was glancing out the window for one more second, it came by again right by the windows, and I clearly saw the black and white markings of the white-throated swift. So that was pretty exciting. And then Wednesday, I mean, so that was 2 days in a row that I got a new species, which was, you know, pretty fun. And then Wednesday, on my lunch hour, I tend to go to the gym that's in the same building we're in. And I was sitting there on the stationary bike, which has these windows looking out on the opposite side of the building from where our offices are, down on the ground floor. And as I'm sitting there biking away for my 30 minutes or 40 minutes, whatever I was doing, I saw this bird fly into the trees outside and sort of be flying around. And it was obviously a flycatcher. Didn't really look like the black Phoebe that I'd already counted in the complex. And it was definitely, you know, smaller than, and not colored the same as the western kingbirds that there's pretty much a bunch of in the complex at this point. It seems to be a big year for Western kingbirds. I see them all over in large numbers. Of course, maybe it's, again, just maybe it's the migration. Maybe that'll taper off as they move on through and reach their breeding grounds. But I wasn't going anywhere, so I sat there and watched him, and eventually it flitted up close enough to the window that I saw the reddish tail and the gray underparts. And it's like, oh, that's a Myarchus flycatcher. That's an ash-throated. And I got back to my desk and broke out the Sibley guide that I bring along with my binoculars. See, there I am. It's because I'm such a fan of Sibley's field guide, you know, that I have such harsh words for him about his unscientific criticism of the ivory-billed woodpecker rediscovery team's arguments. But anyway, whipped out and confirmed that, yeah, that was an ash-throated flycatcher. Or, I mean, it could be any of those. There's like three or four species that are very difficult to distinguish, but that's an identification I'm willing to make just on the basis of, okay, you know, we're in Southern California. Looks like an ash-throated flycatcher. I'm just going to call it an ash-throated flycatcher. That, for me, is a birding frontier I have yet to explore. You know, I've been working the last few years on things like gulls and sparrows, birds that I've tended to not really bother distinguishing amongst in the past, but I'm really working on getting to a new level in my birding identifications to the extent that I can with the amount of time I have available to spend on it. So that was three new species in 1 week in the complex, and I think what's going on there is that we're getting a lot of stray migrants that, you know, birds go flying through, and yeah, they're going to get to places like, you know, the canyons in the Santa Monica Mountains, with the big trees there. It's a much more bird-friendly stopover for a migrant. But if they're heading through Santa Monica, you know, they see all that water, they see those trees, and the occasional bird just plops down in there and hangs out there for a little bit before moving on. And, you know, if you're paying attention, you see those things. And then they had this great story. One of the downsides of my taking this job is that I no longer get to be the parent who has to take William and Julia to their piano lessons. These piano lessons are at William and Julia's piano teacher, an amazing teacher and really wonderful person, Petine Wallen. Her home is up in the hills, up above where we live. So it's about a half-hour drive getting up there, but their home, Petine's and her husband Lawrence, their home is amazing, and it has these wonderful gardens of native plants. And the birds are incredible. And Linda told me, I was so jealous. A bird I've been trying to see for years now, that again, like the black-throated gray warbler, it's a bird that's around the area where I go birding. I just never managed to be in a position to see one. One day that I went specifically to this place to try and see one, where I knew they were to be found, I think I saw just a fleeting glimpse of one flying away, just the briefest glimpse, but not enough to really, you know, satisfyingly claim an identification, and certainly not enough to give me that aesthetic payoff that is the real point of my own bird watching. You know, I'm not really, my conversation so far in this podcast notwithstanding, I'm not all about just ticking off species. I'm not all about just listing. I actually don't have a life list at this point. You know, I had a life list as when I was a younger bird watcher. I gave it up, started listing again those birds that I saw just with Linda, which was fun. But I've kind of fallen away from doing that, and now I don't even really keep track. Sometimes I'll keep a list of a particular outing so I can post it on eBird, so it has some sort of scientific value. Or if I'm birding as part of a Christmas count or a spring census or something, you know, some sort of larger activity, some official activity where it's important to have a list of species and numbers of individuals, then I'll list that. But I don't keep, and obviously I'm keeping this list at the office, so having denied that I keep lists, I then go on to enumerate all the ways in which I do continue to list birds. But I'm not, the mode I'm in right now, I'm really not going to be that satisfied with a fleeting glimpse of this bird. So anyway, she went up to the lesson last week, I think it was. I may have mentioned it. I don't think I did mention it in the last podcast, but if I did, I apologize for repeating myself. And she was sitting on the benches out in this garden, and there were five or six lazuli buntings. Or lazuli buntings, I don't know how it's pronounced. But males in particular are really amazingly beautiful and striking birds. And I would really love to see them, and have not. So I don't think I'm going to see those at work anytime soon. But I'm hoping to go out Saturday, tomorrow, and see if I can find some. There's a road off Highway 33 canyon, I forget what it's called, Canada Larga, I think, that someone was talking about seeing some buntings along with some other great birds. So I think I'm going to try and head out there tomorrow morning and see if I can find some of those buntings along with whatever else I find. You know, one of the things I really do love about bird watching, and I think it does sort of, it does tie in a larger philosophical sense with my interest in the subjects I talk about on lies.com, is that it's a humbling experience. A lesson I've definitely learned from bird watching is that you can, in this case, you can drive right past your off-ramp without realizing it. Got so caught up in talking about birds, I missed my off-ramp. Well, these things happen. I'll be taking the scenic route to Point Magoo today, traveling past the Oxnard Airport. But this lesson I feel that I learned and continually relearn, and unfortunately have a need to continually relearn from birdwatching, is that you have to be open to the unexpected. You can be looking for one thing, and something amazing that you never anticipated will fly right in front of you. And once you realize that and accept that, you see a lot more things that you normally would have missed. I see things at the office park, and people are out there eating their lunch, and I'm strolling through, and I'm checking out little flashes of this and that in the treetops, and getting these thrilling, exciting identifications of things. And everyone around me is completely oblivious. I had the same experience from amateur astronomy, something I also really enjoy, although I haven't done much of lately. I remember one time when we were living down in Manhattan Beach, and I was going to pick up to-go food from the Mexican restaurant downtown, down near the beach. And it was evening, and something I definitely came to appreciate, I was really into astronomy while we were living in L.A. It's kind of perverse. When we lived in Mammoth Lakes up in the mountains with beautiful dark skies, I wasn't so into astronomy. I mean, I had my equipment, and I'd go out there and I'd look sometimes, but, you know, couldn't be bothered some ways. And it was very cold also. But then we moved back to L.A. with this horrible light pollution, and I'm really into it. You know, it's funny. Somewhat ironic, at least by the loose standards of Alanis Morissette songs. But I found myself, while we lived in L.A., really appreciating on an aesthetic level the fact that, you know, L.A. is so ugly in so many ways. The natural beauty of the environment has been degraded so thoroughly and replaced by concrete and asphalt and chrome and telephone wires and everything else. But something that's still available, even in L.A., is the sky. And there are some amazing skies. And I found the contrast of a beautiful sunset above an ugly cityscape. In a way, it makes the beauty of the sky even more beautiful. And I found myself spending a lot of time just walking around looking up at the sky while we were living down there. This one time in particular that I remember, when I was going to pick up this dinner, I stepped out of the car and I'm walking down the sidewalk in Manhattan Beach. And there was a missile launch from Vandenberg. I guess it's kind of funny that after my tirade against the ugly products of human activity, and contrasting that with the natural beauty of the beauty of the natural world, that the thing that actually was so beautiful that I saw this night was the contrail from a missile launch. But it was this amazing, it was the most amazing launch I've ever seen. I've seen a number of them. And it was just, like I say, it was incredible. It was this clear night. It was already dark where we were, late evening, or, you know, late twilight, early evening. But as this rocket ascended, it was just this amazing view. And the staging, there was this, you know, huge blossoming of particles, and it was just an incredible thing, an incredible sight. And I stood there agog on the sidewalk watching this. And besides marveling at the view, I also marveled at the fact that I was being constantly passed by people, none of whom bothered to look up, none of whom noticed this incredible sight. And I have the same experience with bird watching, you know, that like a lot of things, you miss it if you're not open to it. And I think the truth is that way. I think a lot of times we miss it if we're not open to it. And it takes a conscious effort to put yourself in the mental state of awareness and openness and objectivity to appreciate the truth that's out there. That Ray McGovern video, and I actually mentioned this in the posting on the weblog, That coming on top of the Stephen Colbert appearance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, where he roasted Bush and the media, was almost more truth than I can handle. Having that kind of truth coming through a mass medium like the TV after the 5-6 years we've had of the George Bush presidency is really pretty mind-blowing. I sincerely hope and am prepared to work for one or preferably both houses of Congress switching to Democratic control in the upcoming election. And, you know, it's not because I think the Democrats are all morally upstanding, honest saviors of American virtue. A lot of them, and probably the majority of them, are corrupt, dishonest tools of corporate lobbyists and big contributors. But despite that fact, you know, our government just works significantly better if you've got opposing forces in a position to expose each other's lies. And we really haven't had that throughout the Bush presidency. And they are so exposed. They have so much, you know, I think the Bush team is the one that's looked into an abyss recently and is desperate not to head down there, because we're talking crimes, we're talking war crimes, you know, international crimes, domestic crimes, impeachment, disgrace, dishonor. You know, as bad as Bush's approval ratings are today, after a couple years of subpoena power in the House and or the Senate, and hearings controlled by the Democratic Party to actually uncover the stuff that they've been so desperately trying to keep covered, it would not be pretty. But I think that's what this country needs. I think it's what this country deserves. You know, I think the people of the United States, this came out of the Massawi verdict. Am I thinking about this came out of the Massawi verdict and out of watching Stephen Colbert, the Correspondents' Dinner, and out of watching the video of Ray McGovern calling out Rumsfeld. Our country really is better than George Bush. We are more moral than George Bush. We are more intelligent than George Bush. We are more capable than George Bush. We're just better. And in a real way, the Bush era has been marked by the elevation of mediocrity and the lowering of everybody else, because that really is the fundamental approach that Bush takes to the world. It's to lower everything around him so it's beneath him in terms of its abilities, in terms of its effectiveness, in terms of its moral stature. He can only build himself up, and he obviously has a deep emotional need to build himself up. I think, again, this goes back to things I've talked about before, about his childhood and having this overachieving father and this really harsh mother, that as a young kid he was emotionally damaged, and that the scars of that emotional damage are visible today. In that outthrust jaw of his, that way he has of pugnaciously denying the obvious evidence of his own failure, you know, that cocky assertion that he's as good as anybody else, and his willingness to put others down, to keep them down, to use all the tricks and techniques and power and anything else he can come up with, all the resources he can gather, to maintain that illusion, to maintain that fiction that he really is as good as anybody else. And the whole country has been pressed into service in that aim. You know, this morass we're in Iraq, we are in because Bush, so that Bush does not have to admit that he made a really crappy decision to go in there. You know, for us to change our policies in Iraq, for us to stop what's going on there and start fixing it, would require, as a nation, that we acknowledge that what we did before was stupid. And Bush is just emotionally incapable of making that admission. But the American people and the American nation are better than that, and that will come out. The pendulum will swing, and I'm looking forward to it. You know, not with relish, but more with just exhaustion at what we've endured these years under Bush. Anyway, on that hopeful, uplifting note, I will wrap up this podcast, which is copyrighted and distributed under a Creative Commons license. See my website at www.lies.com/podcast for details. I'm John Callender, and thank you very much for listening.